Welcome to Class Matters, an educational program examining the role played by social classes and the class divide in the U.S. and around the world. I'm Rich Whitney.
I'm Paula.
We discuss matters of class because class matters. And of course, one of the places where class matters, in fact, the central place where class matters, is in the economy. We have this division between the capitalist class, the owners of the means of production, and the owners of big finance as well. And we have everyone who must work for them in order to make a living, those people known as the working class. And it's this fundamental division.
Or at least try to. Because there's a lot of unemployed workers.
Yes, yes. This fundamental division causes privation, it causes poverty, it causes the majority of people to struggle to make ends meet, while a very few get richer and richer. That's basically what it's all about. And yet recently in the corporate news media, we've seen a slate of stories talking about how, well, gee, why aren't people responding well to President Biden's message about the economy, you know, the great successes of Bidenomics. Now, it is true that the way they measure unemployment today, it is low by historic standards.
Why, some people have two or three jobs.
That's right. And there is obviously inflation, but what these messengers for the capitalist class and the corporate media keep telling us is, well, but it's getting under control and it's not that bad and real wages have gone up a little and so
private
on and so forth.
Private jets just cost the same as they did 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Plus yachts. Come on now, what are you guys complaining about?
That's right.
The price of eggs? Why don't you just have your private chef go out and source some from an organic egg grower somewhere out in the countryside?
Yeah, why not? What the heck?
Yeah, you could probably get them cheaper that way.
We'll get one of your purchasing agents to take
care
exactly.
of it. Yeah, exactly. No problem. God, the plebes just complain so much.
Exactly. Why don't they appreciate all that Biden has done for them? So with that in mind, we wanted to give you a little different perspective on this whole thing. And we turn again to Matt Taibbi, great independent journalist, whose work you can find at racket.news, easy to find. And he recently wrote a piece just a few days ago entitled, "It's Not Me, It's You," blaming the public's perception of the economy, that being in scare quotes. "People are really tying Bidenomics and their perception of the economy to the inflation rate," said Matt Monday of Morning Consult in a new Bloomberg story titled, "Biden's gains against Trump vanish against deep economic pessimism polls show." It's the latest entrant in an intensifying campaign to describe voters, especially in key electoral swing states, as morons and partisan haters who'll deny reality itself out of political spite.
They should talk. Their whole woke politics is about denying reality.
Yeah.
Just add the economy onto it.
Yep. Yeah. This campaign has been weirdly perverse in its mockery. Seattle Times cartoonist David Horsey recently tossed off a visual of the reality-denying swing voter, rendering him as a pudgy, confused hominid in the mode of Monty Python's dunce-like Gumbies. And he reproduces the cartoon, which says, "If the U.S. economy is the best performing in the world, is it a strong economy?" And then the cartoon shows some dunderhead labeled a swing voter saying, "Gosh, I don't know. It just kind of sort of doesn't feel strong." This is the perception. You know, if you think the economy is not serving you, well, it's your problem. You're an idiot, right?
Well, just as an aside here, using the economy, and Matt's doing it too. He's doing it the way all the propaganda machine does it. And he's adopted that. And everybody does, right? They call the economy as something out there. It's kind of like the gods that must be appeased, right?
Right.
Like the Aztecs used to throw people into the volcanoes so they'd have a good harvest.
Yeah.
At least they connected directly what it is you want out of an economy, right? You want to be able to eat.
Sure.
You know, if your economy doesn't make sure that everybody in your country is fed, everybody is housed, everybody has clean water. And you can go farther. We're a rich country. Everyone have education. Everybody have health care.
Right.
If your economy doesn't do that, then it's not working. And I don't care if inflation is low. If there's homeless people on the street, your economy is not working. And they do the same thing that the primitive people do. They sacrifice people to the economy, by which it turns out the rich, right?
Right.
Oh, another tax cut for the rich. Here, another virgin to the volcano. Another tax cut for the rich, because then they will create jobs.
Yeah.
And jobs will trickle down upon us and we will be bathed in wealth. No. No, if your economy doesn't do the basics for everybody in the country, then it's not working, no matter how many billionaires are created over the last 4 years since they handed out all that money with COVID, right?
Yeah.
What? How many more billionaires were made during those 4 years?
Well, we'll find out. Actually, I have an article that talks about that. But
right. But my point is, we are like primitive people who sacrifice to the great God economy and never think about what we actually want. What we want, I think, or what we should want, is for everybody in the country to be fed, housed, and have proper care.
Right, and
especially
the economy.
Children. Think about the children.
Right. This is mystification, right? The economy, you're absolutely right. The economy is treated as this abstract entity.
Exactly.
That it exists, and policies can affect it, but it's got its own mind and so on.
Yeah, it's like a great beast that has to be fed, but we have no way of controlling it.
Yeah, and in fact, the economy is the sum total of all of our productive activity and all of the things related to that. But in a class-divided society, it is controlled by the owners of the means of production and big finance.
So then you get the talking heads on TV going, good news, housing starts are up. Do they mean by that, good news, people will be housed? No, they don't mean that.
Right.
They mean the economy is working.
Right.
Well, if people aren't being housed, then what's the point? Or they'll go, bad news, housing prices are down. As if that's bad. That one gets me even more, right?
Right, right.
It's good to have housing prices down because then people might be able to afford rent.
Right, but it's bad for the real estate investors.
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah.
My point is what they call the economy is basically the care and feeding and coddling of the rich.
Right, and it's never looked at in class terms, except that they associate the economy with the ruling class.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, they do talk about unemployment, but no one ever really tries to do anything to create work. I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this country.
Sure.
A lot of work that needs to be done. The infrastructure is crumbling. We
right
need
there.
Watersheds. We need trees. We need parks fixed. We need all kinds of stuff like they did in the New Deal, right? But no one ever says, why don't we put people to work doing necessary things? No, it's just we'll feed the economy. And then the economy, by which they mean rich people, will give us jobs.
Right,
it's
right.
It's pathetic.
Like the $90 billion that was just passed for military aid to Ukraine and Israel.
Jobs, jobs, jobs.
Exactly, right. So anyway.
And then, Raytheon workers are working overtime, so they're doing really well. Okay, so how many Ukrainians have to die so Raytheon workers can get some overtime, number one? Number two, what about everyone who's not a Raytheon worker?
Right. And number three, the people who really benefit are the owners of Raytheon.
Exactly.
And
I mean, they are swimming in overtime is what I hear.
Yeah. All right, well, continuing with the article. When the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago ran, "What's Wrong with the Economy? It's You, Not the Data." That was the actual name of the article. I thought the "It's Not Me, It's You" framing had to be ironic, a spoof of these increasingly numerous perception of the economy pieces. Nope, they were dead serious. Noting that 74% of respondents in a recent poll said that they felt inflation in the past year was going in the wrong direction, author Greg Ipp noted flatly, "It's not true," adding, "I'm not stating an opinion. This isn't something on which reasonable people can disagree. If hard economic data count for anything, we can say unambiguously that inflation has moved in the right direction in the past year."
What are they talking about in the right direction?
It's gone down a little.
Well, is that what he really means,
that's
though?
Right.
Because most people, when they say it's going in the wrong direction, they mean it's up. Stuff
right.
is costing way more than it did last year. What does
right.
this guy mean? The rich are getting more money, so that's good. I mean, we have no idea of knowing.
Well, I think he just means that it was up 7 or 8% 2 years ago, and now it's up 5% or whatever. That's the right direction, but that's still bad. It's still going up. That's still harming people. Taibbi goes on to say, "It might be technically right about the last year of inflation, but I'm not sure how many finance writers want to be in the business of deciding who belongs in the reasonable people club, given the last 20 years of unpunished thievery on Wall Street.
Exactly.
One could argue a reasonable person would have marched on Manhattan and started defenestrating bankers 10 years ago.
And you know what? There was Occupy Wall Street, which is very peaceful, very right. peaceful. But you know the bankers were going, oh my God, we got to do something about that. Because these people could move from just hanging around in tents and hearing lectures on inequality. They could move to defenestrating bankers. Jimmy Dore argues that's exactly when woke politics really took off. Because there was a bunch of people there and they were like, we are the 99%. We are united. The 1% is ripping us off. Oh, no, you're not the 99%. You're this group, and you're this group, and you're this group.
Right.
And that group is oppressing you, and that group is oppressing you. And, oh, my gosh, they're so offensive when they say things. That's when it all started, according to Jimmy Dore. I kind of tend to agree with him.
Yeah.
They want to make sure no one defenestrates the bankers, so they get people fighting among themselves.
Right, yeah, instead of going after the ruling class or the ruling class system. In any event, Taibbi goes on and says, many of these articles are about inflation, so it needs pointing out that the CARES Act, a Fed-fueled bailout plan with major inflationary ramifications, passed on Donald Trump's watch. It was bipartisan, but I was critical of it and spent much of 2020 traveling the country for a never-published project on the unfortunately enormous universe of COVID-era finance scams. Voters may trust Trump more because his pre-COVID economy was better, and he signaled he at least listens to public frustrations by criticizing institutions like the Fed. But Biden made moves he should get credit for, too, like trying to lift the bar on bulk pharmaceutical negotiations. Debating which president is better is irrelevant, though. This perception campaign is 100% about press douchebags demonizing people who've been screwed before, during, and after Trump.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
It's the 1%'s mouthpiece demonizing the 99%.
Right, exactly. Especially in the last two decades, the public has been served one financial blankety-blank burger after another. And then he's got a reference to another article he did, which is well worth reading. They've been ripped off by everyone. Banks that sold defective mortgage securities to their retirement funds, pharma companies that charge them thousands per course of medication, private equity titans who strip healthy firms for assets and vaporize jobs, all phenomena that widened inequality and were enabled by hyper-aggressive monetary rescues and stimulus programs like quantitative easing. Yet when they're not sketching swing voters as cartoon dopes, these economic pessimism pieces sooner or later blame the ordinary person for failing to appreciate his or her good fortune. Scripps months ago asked, is the economy the issue or the problem with America's perception? In it, they noted that 78% of the country felt the economy was going in the wrong direction. But is it, the piece asked, stroking its rhetorical chin before adding, after all, most Americans vote not on statistics, but based on how they feel. This is an update of the old coverage trope in which everyone from Occupy protesters, there you go, to Tea Partiers are always described as having passions, while policymakers always have reasons. This new thing is about redefining the economy as a solved issue, but for the hurt feelings of conspiratorial holdouts. CNN last summer sighed about economic perceptions that much of the stagnation comes from dug-in partisans, in a piece about Americans who erroneously, quote, think the economy is getting worse.
Well, you know what this sounds like? This sounds like at the beginning of a campaign to outlaw saying the economy's bad, the way they're outlawing saying an election is stolen.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally throw people in jail for 4 years for saying an election's stolen, even though the Democrats, of course, have been saying it for 6 years.
Yeah.
No longer. That sounds like they're softening people up to, like, if you don't go along with what your ruling class tells you, if Biden tells you that this economy is doing good and you say it isn't, well, then you are engaged in wrongthink.
That's right.
You need to be fined or thrown in jail.
That's right. You're
That'll
violating community
one.
Standards.
Yeah.
That's
the community.
Right.
If, yeah. If the ruling class tells you to think one way and you're not thinking that way, if they define reality and you're like, that's not my reality. No. It's getting more and more draconian in this country where you can definitely be thrown in jail for thinking the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It sounds like they're going to add this to that.
Yeah, you know, a few years ago, I would have said, Paula, you're really exaggerating, or you're reaching. But after what we've been sharing with you listeners about the censorship industrial complex and so on, that we have to entertain this as a possibility.
I mean, we saw Bill Maher just viciously attack Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for saying that vaccines are not safe and effective. And then Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said something about the COVID vaccine, and Bill Maher goes, well, I got it, and I got COVID. And then Robert F. Kennedy says the blatantly obvious, well, then it isn't effective.
Right.
Is it? Because that's what a vaccine is supposed to do. You're not supposed to get a polio vaccine and then get polio and then go, well, my polio would have been way worse if I hadn't had the vaccine. I mean, no one's ever done this before.
Right.
This is all new. This is all groupthink. This is all coming down from the top. And Bill Maher is just engaging in it.
Yeah.
And he's just like, oh, yeah, well, you know, they are effective because probably people would have got sicker. Okay, you're making something up. You are projecting a fantasy. You don't know how sick they would have got.
Right.
But the thing is that vaccines have always been said to stop the disease that you're
right.
being vaccinated
Preventives.
For.
Right.
Right. If you get vaccinated for smallpox, you don't get smallpox. If you get vaccinated for measles, you don't get measles.
Right.
Now they're like, oh, you got vaccinated for COVID and you got COVID anyway. Well, it would have been worse. No,
yeah.
no, no. You can't just redefine reality like that, but that's what they do.
Yeah.
They redefine reality.
They do.
Inflation's not that bad, you say, because, well, last year the rate was 12%, and this year it's 7%. So look at that. It's better.
Yeah.
Except for if things are 7% higher than they were last year.
Right.
But no. You're not allowed to think that.
Yeah, yeah. So Taibbi goes on to cite a Los Angeles Times story on this topic. Economists see a spectacular economy. Most voters don't. Can Biden turn that around? This article recalled a different group of hype artists, and quoting the article, the superlatives from giddy economists read like the promo blurbs on movie ads. Just a perfect report, says Mark Zandi on Moody's Analytics. Stunning and spectacular, says Diane Swank of KPMG. Hard to imagine things could look better, says UBS's Brian Rose. And so on, and there's more quotes.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
But even if you weren't, if you didn't care about inflation, you could still care about homeless people.
Yeah.
They're going on and on about how great the economy is. That's my point at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
If your citizens aren't fed and housed, then your economy isn't working.
That's right.
Period.
Yeah, yeah. But the LA Times was frustrated. Despite all these must-see reviews of Biden's economy from trusted sources like UBS and Allianz, from most Americans, all you get is a Bronx cheer. Some of these articles even show a big reason why stats may not matter at the ground level, but go on to rip the irrational voter anyway. American economic pessimism has been bafflingly persistent despite major indicators showing that the economy is actually strong, wrote Fox last month.
We just need more virgins thrown in the volcano.
Yeah. In yet another piece about gaps between perception and reality in the economy. That same article, however, showed a graph from the Fed charting consumer credit balances, and he reproduces the graph here, and it shows that since 2021, consumer debt has just soared from $750 billion approximately to well over $1 trillion.
I remember a commercial a long time ago on late night TV where the guy's riding his riding lawnmower outside this McMansion he lives mm-hmm. in, and he has his fancy car, and then he says, I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. And it was actually a way to get bankruptcy, or it was something.
Right.
So that was like the most honest commercial I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. That graph by itself explains the American pucker factor. Commentators refuse to see it. They also won't grasp that public mistrust usually has less to do with one-time calculations at the supermarket register than with decades of accumulated frustrations about the increasingly numerous aspects of American life that are straight-up scams or guaranteed income schemes for the failure-proofed rich. For instance, a subtext to the fury about the Columbia University protests this week is the school's obscene $89,000 a year tuition. Reeling in soaring tuition checks from guilt-ridden parents in exchange for an often neither very good nor very useful education is a gravy train any good student loan activist knows is only possible thanks to myriad crookedness baked into the system. Between overavailability of federal credit, an extraordinarily punitive job market, requiring degrees even for menial office work, though the same degrees guarantee nothing, The failure of even public universities to pass ballooning endowments back to students as tuition savings, and the historical inability to discharge student debt in bankruptcy, another area where Biden has taken some action.
Well, wasn't he one of the ones that put it in the original bill that student debt is the only debt that can't be discharged by bankruptcy?
I don't remember when that originally started.
He might
have been, but supposedly he's trying to take care of it now. Anyway, but regardless, colleges can raise prices forever without either improving their product or worrying about students not earning enough to pay bills.
I would just like to say that you should be able to make a living wage without going to college.
Yeah, of course.
If your economy worked.
If your economy worked. If it was economy that worked for the people.
If it was functioning.
Yeah. People aren't stupid. They'll read that Pfizer pulled in $58 billion in profits last year, and every time they go to a pharmacy or see a hospital bill, they'll remember somewhere that these companies benefit from a slew of subsidies, from free R&D to protections from generics and imports, and protections from lawsuits, we might add. When people go to an airport on Thanksgiving, they hear an airline rep telling them that it now costs $30 for a carry-on. Do they know all the relevant history that in the 2010s, executives at the four big airlines gorged themselves on $43.7 billion in buybacks before demanding and getting a $50 billion COVID bailout, which in turn resulted in more buybacks, mass layoffs, and even crappier, more dangerous service? No, but they have a good idea they got screwed somewhere.
There you go.
And occasionally even hear a politician admit it. Buyer's remorse, said D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Norton, characterizing the airline rescue she supported.
Oh, like she didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah. A lot of, quote-unquote, pessimistic voters struggle to pass credit checks just to rent an apartment, but see at the same time that a big bank in America can buy the world's most toxic subprime company, as Bank of America did with Countrywide, or promote murder and mayhem by evading money laundering, as HSBC did by serving drug cartels. And they not only get away with it, but get rewarded with 15 years of low to zero interest rate monetary policies. It's literally impossible to not make money in banking borrowing at zero. You'd actually have to be an actual Gumby to pull it off, which makes it all the more offensive that every article about banks like Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan Chase raves about the amazing smartness of their financial magicians.
Yeah, they do.
Even with all these brains, they can't manage their firms. Pre-COVID, they blew all their gains on dividends and awards, doling out $120 billion in buybacks in 2019 alone, and also had to be rescued in the historic $2.2 trillion COVID bailout.
Well, they didn't have to be rescued. Franklin Delano Roosevelt wouldn't have done that.
Right. They claim they had to be rescued.
Well, and all this nonsense about the economy, that's what they tell us. The economy is in trouble. No, the bankers are in trouble. We must sacrifice someone to appease the gods.
Yeah.
In other words, we're going to sacrifice the working class so the rich can stay rich. Franklin Delano Roosevelt would not have done that.
Yeah.
Or did not do that. He said, the money changers have fled the temple pleading for more credit, and we aren't going to give it to them. And he didn't. And they passed a bunch of laws that were undone gradually. After 40 years of prosperity, starting in the late 70s, and especially in the 90s under Bill Clinton, those laws were destroyed. And then what happened? Crash after crash after crash, and bailout after bailout after bailout.
Yep, yep. And this being one of them.
Yep.
To prop up that pandemic economy and make sure people weren't disenfranchised by those lockdowns we now know we may not have needed at all, our Federal Reserve went on an unprecedented three-year, $5.2 trillion buying spree. That just happened to coincide with a $2.58 trillion bump in the net worth of America's 737, now 808, billionaires.
Well, there you go. See? They got more billionaires.
Yep. The curves for national and international central bank spending and billionaire net worth always overlap smoothly. And then he reproduces the graphs showing exactly that.
Oh, yeah. I would recommend going to this article because it sure makes it clear.
Yep. Most Americans have no objection to people making money, even gobs of it. Perhaps most even respect a decent hustle. We have affection for everything from chia pets to flowbees in America. But when people have no chance at all and money is transferred by the trillions straight from the Fed to accounts of the idiot rich, While hardworking people are asked to pay for it in taxes and inflation, they tend to get pissed off, and it takes them much more than a year to get over it.
No, their perception is wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
And they should not be allowed by law to say so.
Yeah, there you go. Paula was being sarcastic there, just in case.
I'm just saying what's coming. That is what's coming.
Yeah, that's right. The basics, school, medicine, doctor visits, a home, retirement, have become less and less attainable, while politicians keep waving through giant handouts for the scummiest layers of American society, the leveraged buyout artists and forced place insurance carriers and pharmaceutical swindlers, the very people making the obstacles higher. These people also happen to be the largest sponsors of both politicians and media organizations.
Yep, and that's the problem. But in this country, the scum rises to the top.
Yeah.
Just like on ponds.
That's right. These things don't inspire pessimism, but rage. How does anyone justify caricaturing people as dummies for feeling it? And that's that article. Again, you can find that article. It's Not Me, It's You, Blaming the Public's Perception of the Economy by Matt Taibbi at racket.news. With that, wanted to share a little companion piece here from the Brownstone Institute, really good website, which you can find at brownstone.org. They cover a wide variety of topics. And this one is by an economist named Peter St. Ange, entitled, The Rich Get Richer, Thank the Fed.
That's just the perception.
Yeah, that's right.
He'll probably be thrown in jail next. Hmm.
The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and it's all thanks to the Federal Reserve. Last week, the Fed released a new study that wealth of the top 1% in America hit an all-time high of $45 trillion. That's up $15 trillion, or 50%, just from 2020. Wow, I mean, just think about that. The rich have gotten richer by 50% just in the last 4 years.
And that comes out of the pockets of the poor. And when the poor notice, they say, oh, your perception's wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not us, it's you.
Yeah.
No. We create our own reality, and you have to believe it.
Yeah. Put differently, the pandemic response has been just about the best thing to happen to America's rich in, a century. Why? Because the pandemic set off the biggest tidal wave of money printing in American history, pumping out $6 trillion freshly printed dollars in just 2 years.
I wish they quit saying that. It's all on computer.
Well, he does explain this. But This is just setting
it
up.
They keep saying that, printing money. They don't print money. And that's why people are so much in debt. Right? Because they don't see it. They don't have to count out the dollars.
Right.
If people had to count out the dollars, they'd know. Even worse. Instead, they have their little plastic cards they swipe. Man, boy, the prices are really up. Swipe.
Right.
And then they're deeper in debt.
Yep. Yeah. This was roughly 1 in 3 of all dollars in existence before the pandemic. That money, of course, pumped directly into financial markets. Stocks gained $10 trillion over that period. Stocks, capital flows, and many trillions more poured into bonds, not least government debt, treasury bonds, boosted by Federal Reserve purchases. Why did it go to financial markets? Because that's how the Fed prints money. For better or worse, the Fed does not print new dollars on a machine and hand them out to everybody.
Thank you.
Rather, it buys financial assets and subsidizes lending.
And it's all done on computer.
Yep. So-called quantitative easing is buying assets direct, but most of the new money is actually created by banks who literally conjure money into existence when they make a loan. And we've explained this. This is the basics of monetary theory. If you go to the American Monetary Institute, monetary.org, or Ellen Brown's excellent website, you can read more about that. In fact, since the Fed repealed reserve requirements during the pandemic, Wall Street is now free to lend into existence literally any amount their greedy little hearts covet. The end result is new money going first to financial markets and rich people via bank loans. The money then slowly trickles out to the rest of America, often long after prices have risen. This is called the Cantillon effect, and it works like this. A rich guy gets a loan for a swimming pool. The money is spun from nothing. The bank effectively prints it, then charges interest. He takes that fresh money and hires a bunch of workers. He pays them, they go to McDonald's, the McDonald's guy takes his dog to the vet buys a car, the car salesman pays his mom's electric bill, and so on. At each step, the new money spreads wider and wider, and it drives prices higher and higher. So the rich guy got his money first, then each person down the line gets their money progressively inflated away. The last person in line is typically Social Security and pensioners who get nothing but inflation. Well, there's more to this article, but we're just about out of time. Again, you can find this article by Peter St. Onge at brownstone.org, and it's entitled, The Rich Get Richer, Thank the Fed. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you again next Monday.